to the March edition of the BBRO Beatcast. I'm Francesca Broom, your host and Knowledge Exchange Manager for BBRO. This month, we're joined by Professor Mark Stevens and Dr. Simon Bowen to discuss the outcome of the Rothamsted virus forecast and why modelling is so important to the sugar beet industry. So welcome both to Beatcast, March edition. It'd be fair to say that the last few weeks for anyone involved in sugar beet have been a little bit on the tense side, whilst we've all been waiting for the Rothamsted virus forecast to be released. With such a mixed bag of weather events, from the snow to the warm sunshine, and the balance hanging on a bit of a knife edge as to whether the derogation for the use of Cruiser SB being triggered, I know the deadline has just passed, Mark, as the 1st of March. So can you just tell us the result and what this is going to mean for growers for this year?
Good morning, everybody. Thank you, Ches. Clearly, this has been a major discussion point, and we can now confirm, following the information from Rothamsted, that the virus yellows forecast that was provided on the 1st of March 2021 shows that 8.37% of the UK sugar beet area is at risk of going yellow by the end of August 2021. Now, that figure is very low compared to 2020 and reflects, as you've just highlighted, the really variable and cold weather periods that we've had throughout January and February. But it does mean, you're correct in all your statements, is that we will not now be using Cruiser SB for the UK sugar beet crop. The weather that we have had, the large number of ground frosts, variable diurnal range and temperature, will have all had a big impact on overwintering aphid populations. And as a consequence of that, we do not anticipate the first aphids to fly into the current crop until the third week in May. And again, that could be influenced by ongoing temperatures through March. But we're at the moment anticipating that May the 18th is the most likely date that we'll see the first winged Mysis persici. But that will be the first ones. It will take time for them to build up, if they do build up. So we really don't anticipate aphids showing in any significant level until we get into June, possibly even July. Again, so much different to 12 months ago, when the aphids were flying from the third week of March and in large numbers really from April onwards. And, you know, as we go into this season, when those aphids are coming into the crop, that crop is going to be at the 6, 8, 10, even 12 leaf stage. So you'll start to see inherent plant resistance kicking in. And we also need to remember the forecast that has been produced by Rothamsted, and that what we're all talking about today, is in the absence of any pest management approach. And we've got to remember that we do have other tools in this integrated pest virus management strategy that we're all adopting. We currently will have Topiki as a foliar spray that's fully approved, and BBRO with British Sugar and the NFU sugar teams have applied for foliar assistance with additional products through the emergency authorization process. So I fully anticipate, if we need sprays, and we all know about when it comes to sprays, there are the thresholds that we have, we'll have a program that can be applied if we get above the one green wingless aphid per four plants to limit the spread of aphids and virus. So we do have those tools, and also there will be beneficial insects that will also play a major role in the season. I've already been encouraged that I'm seeing quite large numbers of ladybirds in recent days following the very warm end of February. That may or may not mean they're in synchronization with aphid populations, and that will be closely monitored as we go through the season. But they certainly will have a role to play in controlling aphids through May, June and July. And so I have every confidence that we are very different to the rest of Europe, where we're relying on a science-based approach using a virus yellows trigger, and the risk from virus yellows, thanks to the Rothamsted forecast, indicates a very different risk to where it was 3 or 4 months ago. It doesn't mean to say there'll be no virus, because clearly there will be. Now, we're anticipating to see some virus, and I'm sure as the season progresses, there will be one or two local hotspots that we'll need to keep a very close eye on. But as it stands today, the risk is very low, which is great news for the industry.
So it's great that we can rely on the model, and we're fairly confident that, you know, the information it's telling us will bear fruit, because it's been the same for a number of years. Now, you've mentioned May the 18th as being the date where we're expecting aphids to be flying. Can you just give us a bit of background to the actual model? The Research Institute obviously rely an awful lot on these models to predict things, and as I say, I know you're confident on that result. Why she lies behind the model? What makes that tick?
So we are fortunate that there has been a type of virus yellows model since the end of the 1950s, early 1960s. And there have been various iterations of that as advances have been made and changes have been made to the model. But we are fortunate to have a run of data that goes back over 55 years that has been able to give us a risk profile in early March of what may happen to the crop at the end of August. Now, that model does take into consideration several factors. Clearly, temperature is important, and the current model takes into consideration the mean temperature experienced in January and February. And the lower that temperature, the greater the impact that has on overwintering aphid populations and reducing the levels of virus. So the temperature influences aphids. The model takes into consideration what's happened previously as well with those aphid populations. And it can take into consideration pest management strategies like using seed treatments. And it can give an indication of the risk depending on the growth stage of the crop as well. But the combination of temperature and weather on aphid populations are probably the key factors, because, as I've already said, the later those aphids come into the crop, the greater the chance the crop is at a decent growth stage. Even if we do see some virus, the less impact that will have on yield. So we have all these factors that come into play to enable us to produce this forecast. And as I said, it's been there for many years and used by BBRO to give an indication of the risk each year.
So we're looking at the Rothamsted model. Obviously, as BBRO, we've got a number of other models that we're actually looking at the moment. And I believe, Simon, you've been involved with implementing some of these and seeing what else we can do to support the industry. So how else are we using modelling to create information for growers?
Okay, so I think one of the big models that many growers in the industry might be familiar with is what we call the beet growth model. Again, a model developed on the back of some really good extensive research back in Broome's barn. And effectively, it allows us to model yields. So it's got quite some complex equations in it, as you can imagine, all linked together in what we call an algorithm. Maybe useful just to explain what an algorithm is, because it's a word which has crept into the English language of late, isn't it? Algorithm is essentially a set of rules or processes, usually it denoted by a calculation, which allows us to combine factors, predict an effect. It's a formula, effectively. Those are familiar, cast their minds back to maths at schools. And the beet growth one is quite a complicated one, because it allows us to take a number of factors, whether it's weather, and that's not just rain, it's light levels, of course. It takes soil characteristics, takes temperatures, and it allows us to predict the various phases of the growth of the sugar beet crop, such as emergence, and then the canopy development, of course. And allows us to predict that. And of course, then it has to try and predict the amount of sugar produced and how much of that sugar as part of the dry matter is partitioned into root as well, how much is partitioned into top growth. It's a very sophisticated model. It's one we have looked at, and over the last two years, we've upgraded a little bit, because I think when the model was first developed, there was a couple of areas we needed to consider, particularly the emergence of crops in dry conditions, and also very importantly, how the canopy of crops persist in the autumn. Bear in mind, when a lot of the early work does, we weren't using fungicides, we had different varieties. And it was really important to be able to model and predict canopy persistence into the autumn, because obviously we do quite a lot of yield. We produce quite a lot of yield in that period. So this model's been upgraded. Many of you have met Toby Townsend. He worked for BBRO on a three-year KTP, working with Professor Neil Kraut at Nottingham University, who's an expert modeler as well, to make some of those upgrades. And actually, we also got back in contact with some of the original scientists, such as Keith Jagger, to get their help and get some key indicators of where we probably needed to improve it. That model's now been improved. We've been using it now. And of course, many of you, you'd be probably familiar. That sits at the heart of initiatives such as the Beet Yield Challenge, where we model what the crop is potentially able to produce, compare it with the actual yields. And now, of course, it sits in the kind of, if you like, the engine compartment of the Beet Yield Tracker, which allows us to track yields, and it's more of an online yield tracking tool. So we've used it. But that model's been used in many other projects in BBR as well. Mark's even used it in the Spore ID product to actually use it to predict impacts of diseases on yields. And if you remember, we did a project with Tim Hess of Cranfield University when we used the model to do the irrigation work. So it has multiple uses, isn't it? And it's a fantastic tool to have with us. And I can tell you many other research institutes abroad are quite envious of our tool and often say, can we have a copy of it? Now, at this moment, it's a definite no, because it's for us to use uniquely for the benefit of the UK beet industry. But it's a tool there, and it's one we have and we do use.
So, yeah, Simon, you're correct in what you said about models for disease. And we have investigated and developed and utilised this growth model with the Spore ID project that BBRO instigated through Innovate UK funding in recent years. And what we're able to do is understand the crop growth and then link it to conditions to try and then provide and identify the risk profile. And we've made some advances, and I think with time we'll make further advances, particularly as we start to use varieties and future fungicides more tactically. And I think some of the work that Simon's been doing and highlighted really very nicely in the Beet Review in the latest edition is the Cercospora element. Because Cercospora clearly has caused us some major problems in 2020, and we need to keep another close eye on that for 2021. But what we've been able to do is take other models elsewhere globally. There's no point reinventing the wheel when there are models that we could exploit. And Simon's done that to identify risk periods to potentially target products for Cercospora control as we go forward. So, Simon, can you tell us a bit about some of that work you've been doing?
Mark, that's absolutely great, because actually the Cercospora risk model provides really nice contrast with the beet grow model. Whereas the beet grow model is a really big, I call it a big fat model with multiple complex algorithms in it. It's like the BMW of really complex electronics. Yeah, when it comes to Cercospora, we're actually moving to that actually quite simple, but simple is quite elegant sometimes and very simple to work and very reliable. It's a bit like the VW Golf model. And effectively, we know when it comes to Cercospora, and many of you who grow potatoes will be familiar with that, it's often down to simple interactions of temperature and humidity. And actually, there is, as Mark said, there's models which have been developed in North America, very well validated, and they've been tested in Spain as well. And we've been able to get hold of those models and understand how they work. And they do work on a simple kind of interaction of the number of hours in a day when the humidity is above 90% against temperature. And I have a very simple chart which shows how the risk of Cercospora, and we call the risk in terms of DIV, which is daily infection values, increases. Now, that can be converted into a model, i.e. a very simple algorithm can be created for that. And of course, then we can take measurements from MET stations and sensors in the crop, which we will be doing this year, and convert that into a risk, which we know is well validated. But we did do a little bit of validation work last year and clearly showed that in the middle of August, we hit some real high-risk periods for Cercospora, and that's where many of the infections stem from.
And I think where we can add in the future is what we are able to do is take a lot more detailed assessments of the crop. As tools and technologies become available, you've only got to look at the work that Georgina Barrett and Alistair Wright are doing now in BBRO. you know, were able to use the latest drone camera systems and look at spectral reflectance and other key parameters that then add an extra layer of complexity within those models, not to make them more complicated, but hopefully give more sophisticated answers so we can put targeted treatment on at the right time, at the right place, under the right weather conditions to have a greater impact on the crop going forward, ultimately, which benefits disease control and ultimately yield.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, Mark, and it's very interesting. Well, the Cercospora model we will be running in its simplest form for growers in 2021, so we'll be able to give them some risk based on temperature and humidity. I'm already getting some questions, growers, about what about different varieties? How do I factor that into the model? Is the risk different if I've got a more susceptible variety? Now, we are beginning to collect information on that, and this is Mark's point exactly, and we will be able to hopefully add on another layer of sophistication and saying, well, if you are growing variety X, your risk is low, but if you're growing variety Y, your risk has hit, you need to be focusing on this one. And it goes to show how we can develop the sophistication. But I have to say, sometimes simplicity is best in models, and sometimes they can get a little bit too complex, and we'd be really careful, you know, when we do step them up, and they need to be quite well tried and tested in the field as well. But Cercospora risk model, watch out for it. BBRO will be sharing that with you as and when the season progresses and we get to that stage, from probably about June, July onwards.
But as you've both mentioned there, that the model is going to be providing information to growers, but the information we can provide is only as good as the information we put into the model, so the data that we've received. So how many years worth of data do you really need before you can be confident about the advice that we can give?
I think it depends on what you're trying to model. It may not always be a time factor. Sometimes it may be you need a model to be sure that it's robust across different soil types, for example. I think it depends on what you're trying to model, really. I mean, I do think there's this kind of ingrained thought that, you know, you've got to have a model and test it for 20 years before it comes valuable. I dispute that slightly. And I think, you know, you can do a lot of testing. And of course, what's really relevant now, the tools we have at our disposal, and Mark mentioned this, to collect information, particularly from remote sensing, aerial sensing, we can collect lots of data really quickly. And probably in a year, we can collect now data which probably took several years to collect historically. So I think that whole process can be sped up quite massively, and we can make these developments much faster than we have in the past. There's a proviso to that, of course. Of course, we need to make sure we've got the right resources, not just the tools, but also the people in the business who know how to do this kind of work with these technologies and techniques. And I say we're very lucky in BBRO. We've got two members of the team, Alistair and George, who come from university, and they're taught these kind of techniques as they come from university, and they've used them in their PhDs as well. So we have that ability to complement the old fogies like myself and Mark, who tend to draw on experience.
But of course, we do have access to quite a lot of historical data as well. So any new model can actually draw on information from a number of previous years, can't it?
And Ches, that's a fantastic point to make. So confidence is key. So Simon's alluded to, we'll potentially see new models come available, and you want to use them in real time to make real time decisions to have an impact on farm. But anything that we do develop using historical data sets, you can then test and prove whether or not you then using the actual situation to give you confidence in what you're trying to develop. So it's a really good point to make. The beauty of having long-term data sets to make a difference. And I'm sure, you know, we talked about the virus yellow situation, the beauty of that, having that for over 50 odd years to give and understand what's happened in recent decades. And that will be the case with Cercospora and other issues as we go into the future. So models have a lot to give, but data to drive them is so, so important to give you the confidence of deliverables at the end of it.
And that's where often the growers come in, because it would be great to have more information from growers of what they see on field. You know, tell us what varieties got, any issues they see that we can all add into this model.
The more data we can have, the better. And I think, again, it has to be of the right quality. So one thing that we really all need to emphasize and beat and make sure that we capture it whenever we can are all those levels of information. So it's knowing what soil type, it's knowing the drilling date, it's knowing what variety has been introduced, it's knowing the crops emerged and established, because all those subtle differences really give you the detail that you need to make the difference.
And I think there's an interesting point there that it is all about data. And currently, the process tends to be the data is collected by a research organization, such as BBRO. We develop models and we put the messaging out. If I'm allowed, I'd love to just glimpse the future a little bit on this one. And we're beginning to see it already. In the future, these models will sit in the farm office. You know, the farm office is becoming like your flight control deck of your crops, and you will have these real time in front of you because the information will be collected remotely. It will be coming right to you and give you decisions. It will begin to bypass, I think, research organizations in the future. Yes, we will do the work to make sure that the models are right, but actually growers more and more will actually be able to make decisions and see that information real time. And I really do believe that is the case. And you can begin to see with some of the data platforms which are already being developed and made available to growers. And it's really quite an exciting times. We do need to understand, you know, we've got to embrace the data age 100% and realise and unleash the power in it all.
Does that mean we're going to end up with an Audi version that's going to be sitting in the farm office, is it?
Well, quite possibly. You perhaps be careful now and say other makes of cars are available. But absolutely. And it's a great analogy to see how sophisticated the electronic control systems have come in our cars, isn't it? And some of them using satellite imagery and satellite navigation systems. You know, there's an obvious parallel what's happening in farming when it comes to making key decisions.
Well, it's thanks to the Rothamsted model that we now have a key decision on the seed treatment for 2021. And as you've both mentioned, there is more info available on the February's Beet Review and in the March Advisory Bulletin. There's also an opportunity for growers to ask their own questions of the BBRO team at the Beet Tech 21, which launches on the 8th of March. Four videos covering virus, seed beds, weed control and Cercospora. And this is then followed by the 11th of March, a live question and answer session with the BBRO science team. And special guest speaker, Pam Chambers from UPL. Pam will be covering weed control and is a font of knowledge on that subject. So that's all from us. Thank you very much for listening, and we'll look forward to catching up with you very soon.